Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, April 6th. Let's begin this new week with a little bit of humor, because we could all use it, right? The satirist from The New Yorker, Andy Borowitz, posted this on The New Yorker site on Saturday. It's a picture of President Trump with the headline, "Fauci urges non-essential worker to go home." And it says, "Dr. Anthony Fauci has urged a non-essential employee of the White House Coronavirus Task Force to go home immediately. Speaking of that particular worker, Fauci says, he said that he felt fine coming to work every day, but I told him, you may feel fine, but by coming into work, you are endangering the lives of countless others." He's got another piece too, Borowitz, that says, "Fauci tells Trump he has to cancel the parade that was going to be to Trump to celebrate what a great job he's doing with the coronavirus." So to be very clear, that is satire entirely made up by the New Yorker humorist Andy Borowitz. But with that, we welcome a real White House correspondent on the news since Friday, such as the national recommendation that people cover our faces when we go out. The federal government will pay hospitals for treating uninsured coronavirus patients. That's big. The continued tug of war between Trump and the states over the national stockpile of ventilators and PPEs. And oh, by the way, he fired the intelligence community inspector general around 11 o'clock Friday night, hoping we wouldn't notice that act of retribution against the independent watchdog who brought the Trump-Ukraine whistleblower complaint to Congress. But we noticed. Our real White House correspondent is Jonathan Lemire from the Associated Press. Welcome back, Jonathan. Thanks for coming on with us.
My pleasure, Brian. It's always great to talk to you.
And there is some good news as well as bad news today. Let's deal with both things. I'm going to run down a few items here first. The bad news, we all know, the worst weeks for coronavirus deaths and hospital overloads begin today. The U.S. Surgeon General, Vice Admiral Jerome Adams, on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, didn't sugarcoat it.
"This is going to be the hardest and the saddest week of most Americans' lives, quite frankly. This is going to be our Pearl Harbor moment, our 9/11 moment, only it's not going to be localized. It's going to be happening all over the country. And I want America to understand that."
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says there are enough ventilators to fully go around, maybe only until tomorrow. Some of the good news also comes from New York, however. The number of coronavirus deaths actually went down from Saturday to Sunday, indicating that maybe social distancing is starting to have an effect, according to Governor Cuomo.
"The number of deaths over the past few days has been dropping for the first time. What is the significance of that? It's too early to tell."
And at the White House briefing last night, Dr. Deborah Birx said Italy and Spain are starting to show slower rates of the disease, a sign that distancing is working there. Here's Dr. Birx.
"When we were talking about why we are hopeful, well, hopeful because last time I was here, I wasn't able to really tell you that Italy and Spain were coming across their apex and coming down the other side. And I think to me, that's extraordinarily hopeful. They just completed 4 weeks of really strong mitigation. And I think that's our word to the American people, is we can look like that."
And President Trump last night put his usual rosy spin on things, saying this.
"We see light at the end of the tunnel. Things are happening. Things are happening. We're starting to see light at the end of the tunnel."
So Jonathan Lemire, AP White House correspondent, our guest, maybe both things are true. An awful few weeks begin today, the hardest in the lifetimes of so many Americans, like the Surgeon General said. But maybe at the same time, the first glimmers of the light at the end of the tunnel, as Trump put it, longer term, are beginning to emerge. Is that what we should take from the variety of facts and messages?
There do seem to be some hopeful signs, particularly in the cases out in the West Coast, Washington State, California, even in New York. The governor had said last couple of days that the number of hospitalizations had leveled off, had dropped a little bit. But I think those bright lights are going to be overwhelmed by the darkness in the next week or two. I think that the Surgeon General's warnings are probably going to carry with all Americans these next few days. He suggested this will be among the hardest weeks of all of our lives, that the death rate is going to rapidly escalate. People will be coming to the hospital all over the country. The epicenters will grow beyond just New York and a few other places. He also compared it to September 11th, to Pearl Harbor, and called for a moment of national resolve. And that's, but that brings me to a striking difference between this administration and those. The federal government, Washington, led the response after September 11th, led the response after Pearl Harbor. And that does not seem to be the case here, where time and again, this White House seems content to put the onus on the states. And we can get into this, but that includes the national stockpile. They're changing the very definition of the stockpile and how states can access it. That includes the president continuing to feud openly with some governors whose states are on the front lines of this crisis. And that includes the president giving voice to the potential of an anti-malarial drug being almost a wonder drug in terms of helping patients with coronavirus, even though members of his own health advisory board, including Dr. Fauci, continually have to pour cold water on that, saying
right,
it's simply too early to know.
And let's hold that chloroquine conversation for a little later in a few minutes. We'll get back to that and look at it a little bit. But on your first point, and I see your latest AP story is headlined, Trump administration tries to narrow stockpile's role for states. And how intense a conflict of this is this? Well, yesterday, Mayor de Blasio said New York City has 4,000 people currently on ventilators and enough left just until tomorrow or Wednesday as the demand continues to grow. He said the city would need another 1,000 just to last this week without doctors having to deny life-saving care to some people. And he pleaded for machines from the federal government stockpile, which reportedly has 10,000 of them. Jonathan, if that 10,000 ventilators number is accurate, what are they holding them for?
I think the president yesterday tried to change the narrative on this a little bit and discussed about some of the supplies they're sending out. But it comes back to the sort of basic conflict here. The difference, the idea of the White House, the Trump administration, not being at the forefront of the response. So let's back up a few days. We'll start at the beginning of this crisis, where the president has always said that he prefers the states to be take the lead on this, that in terms of acquiring medical equipment, believing that they have existing relationships with manufacturers and distributors, that also informed his reluctance to fully invoke the Defense Production Act, where he could have compelled private industry to make more. He was very slow in putting that into place. He now has used it in a few targeted examples. And then last week, we had Jared Kushner make his debut, president's son-in-law and influential White House advisor, whose role has grown in the coronavirus response task force, make his debut at the White House briefing room, I believe it was last Thursday, and talking about how the stockpile is meant as a reserve, that it was meant for the federal government to have rather than to be readily available for the states. And the very next morning, just hours after Kushner finished speaking, the Health and Human Services website changed its definition of the strategic national stockpile to reflect what he had said. And the president has now defended
that. What was the old definition?
The old definition, I can read it to you, in fact. Until Friday, it said that the nation's, I'm going to quote the website here, quote, the nation's largest supply of life-saving pharmaceuticals and medical supplies for use in a public health emergency severe enough to cause local supplies to run out. When state, local, tribal, and territorial responders request federal assistance to support their response efforts, the stockpile ensures that the right medicines and supplies get to those who need them most during an emergency. But as after Kushner spoke the next day, this language was added. The stockpile's role, and I'm quoting again, is to supplement state and local supplies during public health emergencies. Many states have products stockpiled as well. The supplies, medicines, and devices for life-saving care contained in the stockpile can be used as a short-term stopgap buffer when the immediate supply of adequate amounts of these materials may not be immediately available.
Okay.
That change, just a final point, what Kushner said and the change of the definition has prompted a number of Democratic senators to call for an investigation.
So that semantic difference, whether it was done retroactively to back up something that Jared Kushner stumbled into saying or for whatever reason, doesn't change the fact, again, if this number is accurate, that they have 10,000 ventilators in the national stockpile right now, and this would be a moment to use the backup for the state supply if Mayor de Blasio's projection is right, that New York City will run out tomorrow. So do you know if that 10,000 ventilators number is accurate, and if so, what are they holding them for?
We don't know the precise number there. The federal government has been cagey in saying that. There was talk last night that some of those will be sent to the states, and that includes New York. But the exact timetable, the exact number is not clear. I suspect that's something we will hear more about today at today's task force briefing, which is at the moment slated for 5 o'clock.
And you reported that in Connecticut, Governor Ned Lamont told CNN last week that his state couldn't get personal protective equipment from the national stockpile. The federal government stockpiles that too?
It does. And it's been it varies wildly from state to state who's been able to get what. There are some states like Florida where local officials there say they have received everything they've needed. Every request they've given, the federal government has been able to fulfill. Other states, one that was mentioned in particular that we've reported upon is Oklahoma, where the crisis has not become particularly significant yet. And they've received supplies they didn't even ask for. Some governors are pleased. We've heard Governor DeWine from Ohio the last few days say be complimentary of the White House approach. Some of the president's usual rivals, like Gavin Newsom in California, has also done so, although some of that, according to our reporting and others, is an effort, Newsom, to get out ahead on television to praise the president, to sort of manage that relationship in order to get the best possible the response from the federal government. And then, of course, we've had Governor Cuomo here in New York, Mayor de Blasio. He's more contentious, more back and forth. Cuomo and Trump in particular have moments where they're praising each other and then other moments quite critical. But Cuomo, of course, we have seen him more or less plead with the federal government to supply the ventilators they need.
At the briefing last night, the president more or less praised Cuomo and de Blasio, but had harsh words for the governor of Illinois, Pritzker. What's between Trump and Pritzker?
Governor Pritzker has been on television very critical of the president. And this is one of the defining things that's related to the stockpile, of course, is the relationships between the state houses and the White House are so key in the response to this. We have seen governors try to manage their relationships with the president. I just mentioned Governor Newsom. Governor Cuomo is another who has sort of alternated between praising him and criticizing him. Others, like Whitmer in Michigan, Governor Whitmer in Michigan, Pritzker in Illinois, have been far more out front in terms of attacking the White House response, trying to get the White House's attention on television, knowing that's in many ways the best way to get them to move on something is if the president happens to see your cable news hit. And if we're going to do a fact check, which the Associated Press is very fond of and quite good at doing, yesterday the president spoke at the briefing and said that it didn't matter if the governors were appreciative of the federal response. It didn't matter if the governor said nice things about him. We can unequivocally say that is, if we're going to fact check that, that's false. The president has, at other times, very much clearly said that how governors treat him factors into this. And we've reported in depth, behind the scenes reporting, among White House aides who know there's an expectation in the building that in order, you know, to not risk not getting what you need to be nice to the president on television.
Here's a question from a listener via Twitter. The question is, has anyone considered the idea that Trump may be holding these supplies for his red state fans?
I don't know that there's exact evidence of that, but there is a red state, blue state divide that has emerged here. Last week, when the president hurriedly floated the idea of a quarantine of New York City and parts of New Jersey and Connecticut, part of the calculation there was, and it came after a conversation with the governor of Florida, part of the calculation inside the White House was that even if it was not fully enforceable and the governors of the three states involved suggested it wouldn't be, that it wouldn't be federal authority. But even if it wasn't enforceable, it would be a signal to the rest of the country, including those red states full of Trump supporters, that the president is doing his best to kind of wall off, if you will, the problem, the hot spots, from the rest of the nation where things weren't as bad. That breakdown, though, that divide, however, is breaking down simply because the virus has spread throughout the country. Florida is widely expected to be the next real hot spot over the next couple of weeks. New York might be getting its peak now, next week or two. Florida is a few weeks behind that. We're seeing a surge of cases in Louisiana, of course, another Trump state. And there are others, Ohio, another one that voted for the president in 2016, that are starting to really struggle with the number of cases. Exactly. Michigan is a
big
example.
Swing state, crucial swing state.
These are states that are also now having real upticks in cases, and therefore the president's approach will have to be different. It can't just be done on political calculations. Although part of it, as a final thought, there are, of course, some states, all with Republican governors, who have not enforced any sort of stay-at-home measures or any sort of efforts to kind of lock things down and stop the spread. So there's real concern that those states may soon be the next hotspots.
I do want to make sure that we say this, because I think this is good and very important, and it might have gotten lost because it happened on Friday afternoon, or tell me if I'm over-interpreting this. At the president's briefing on Friday, I believe he said the federal government will pay hospitals directly to treat uninsured coronavirus patients. He had said earlier in the week that he was not reopening the window for signing up for Obamacare insurance policies, that he was going to do something better. And I presume this is it. And maybe this really is better if the federal government would really pay the hospital bills for uninsured coronavirus patients without them even having to go through insurance companies or anything. Do I have that right?
You do. I think the so often what influences this particular president is to not do things that his predecessor did. So I think there's a reluctance in some ways to open up these Obamacare exchanges simply because the name Obama appears in the title. And still, even though, of course, a large portion of Obamacare remains in place, the Republicans' efforts to scuttle it have not fully worked. You know, this is still something that they hope that at least as a mission statement, they hope to do. So instead, they have come across this. There's the $100 billion fund that was part of the package that was passed in Congress a few weeks ago. That is going to be used to give these direct payments to hospitals to cover the bills for the uninsured who are dealt with this coronavirus. Now, we need to see that obviously roll out and happen in the days ahead, you know, the effectiveness of that. But certainly, you know, that is the plan as stated by this White House.
To me, the biggest lie that we hear news conference after news conference from the president is a lie of context. He says, we now have more tests than South Korea or any other country, 1.something million tests. Maybe that's true as a matter of sheer numbers, but in terms of the population of the United States, 350-ish million, we'll find out if they manage to complete the census this year, which is another story. But in the context of the population of the United States, it's minuscule compared to what they were able to do in South Korea and a few of those other places where testing was the key to containment. So until we get maybe hundreds of millions of tests, literally, we're not going to be able to reopen in that particular way, really knowing who's negative, who's positive, sequestering the people who are positive or who have been exposed, and being able to go about our business that way. And so he lies, I'll call it that, by portraying the 1 million tests as a success when it's really a miserable failure.
You are exactly right. America has a significantly larger population than South Korea. Percentage-wise, the testing capabilities here has been woeful. And that is, and until that improves, there is going to be real reluctance in corners of this country to resume everyday life. It has become sort of a somewhat famous anecdote at this point. But the same day that the United States had its first coronavirus case. South Korea had its first coronavirus case. And within days, over in Seoul, they assembled leaders of industry in the basement of a train station. And the government had a meeting and empowered them all to get out there and to mass produce, work around the clock to create tests, effective tests. They're able to do so. They were able to keep the virus in check. Certainly there were deaths there, there were patients there, but at a far smaller rate than other countries, particularly in the United States. And we're seeing in South Korea the first steps to reopening the country again. We are, and obviously it did come, we are so far behind that there is no suggestion, despite what the president said, no health expert would recommend the reopening of this country anytime soon.
And by the way, that isn't just a Trump failure. There was a good long article about that over the weekend. I'm forgetting the source. I think it was the Washington Post. But this was a Centers for Disease Control failure. This was a Food and Drug Administration failure. So this was a federal government failure that really the experts never predicted would happen in the United States on several levels of government at the federal level. Several agencies of government at the federal level, not just Donald Trump, to be clear, right?
That is correct. It was a widespread systematic failure. The CDC, I believe it is a Washington Post article you're referring to, that they did not allow private companies to design their own tests initially. They wanted to rely on their own, sort of a hubris in the agency. Their initial tests failed. It was only after that that they allow others to put it to work, and it cost the country precious weeks in their response. Let's remember, it was at the CDC nearly a month ago when the president, walking through the hallways there wearing his campaign hat, said, anyone in America who wants a test can get a test. We've heard since then the vice president say that there would be drive-up testing facilities established in Walmarts and Targets all over the country. None of that has happened. Has testing improved? Sure, it has. There have been steps that have been made, but it is still a long way to go. And New York City is a terrific example. You can only get a test in New York City, for the most part. If you are someone who is so sick, you're probably going to need to be admitted to the hospital, potentially for life-saving measures. If you are someone who just is somewhat ill, or someone who's asymptomatic but could still be spreading it, you can't get a test.
We're just about out of time. I just want to come back to the president's promise from Friday's briefing to have the federal government pay for the treatment of uninsured coronavirus patients. We got a tweet from a listener just now who said, my husband was on a ventilator twice in the past year, 3 days each time. The bill each time was $45,000. Insurance negotiated a rate less than half of that. What will Trump pay? I know you don't know the answer to that question, what the reimbursement rate will be. But do you know if this promise will cover all uninsured patients, like regardless of immigration status, for example?
The president was asked that very question last week and sidestepped it. There is not a firm answer just yet whether or not that will be the case. And there certainly are concerns, though, as we just said, some have lauded this idea. There are concerns that it's not enough money, particularly as the number of cases, the pool of money that these payments we've drawn from is not substantial enough, considering the cases are going to skyrocket across the country. Also, that there are people there that won't help people in certain parts of the country where the healthcare system is not as effective. So there's a lot of this is still being sorted out. We will learn more in the coming days and weeks, but it shouldn't be viewed as a cure-all. It shouldn't be viewed as something that will just automatically relieve the patient's worry. I think that it is too early to know that, and I think this is an administration, at least to this point, most Americans would not give the benefit of the doubt in terms of how they've handled this crisis.
Associated Press White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, It's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.